As always, though, we get the hour underway by welcoming into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His most recent book, Scrooge, available now. Phenomenal, life-changing. What more do I need to tell you? Get the book. You'll be happy you did. Colin, good afternoon.
Hey, what's up?
I have to check. You are a Zulu warrior of the highest order. I want to know, were you able to conquer any steps today?
No, today, but it wasn't because I couldn't. I was embroiled in completing the things that I sent you. And actually, yesterday, I shouldn't lie. I was a bit lazy yesterday with the whole steps thing, and I had done 10 days in a row, and I figured, you know what, maybe that would just rejuvenate me a bit to take a day off. And then today was today, and it was like, oh no, this isn't what I want to be doing.
Well, we're going to talk blues today. When did you first become a fan of the blues?
That's a good question. In one sense, I don't think that's the way you mean it, I've always been a fan of the blues, Kimball, because the blues is the musical bedrock of so many different things. For instance, the Beatles' She Loves You is a very bluesy song. We don't think of it that way, but it is. And the Beatles did a version, multiple versions of the song, of Matchbox by our man. We'll get to Blind Lemon Jefferson. But the actual blues is like the outright blues that people think of as the blues. I was always into like bands like Led Zeppelin that had that blues element, but I'll tell you, it was quite interesting. When I was in college, it's really the only worthwhile thing I got out of college, I was writing a thesis, and it was supposed to be about like vorticism, kind of poetry, and like Ezra Pound and stuff, and that didn't happen. It became something about rock and roll, really, and I found as I was writing this thesis that the real quote-unquote hero of the thesis, and I hadn't intended this way, was Robert Johnson. So I was really writing about Robert Johnson when I thought I was writing about all these other different things. So I was pretty connected with his music, which of course I knew well before then, but that's when I really realized his significance. And from there, it was like, it's kind of like me in ghost stories. Like Elvis would say, there wasn't a gospel song he doesn't know. For me, I feel like there's not a ghost story I don't know, and there's not like a blues song, a blues artist. It's sort of like obscure holes you go down and find all of these great musicians to listen to.
Well, we're going to listen to a little bit of some great samples of the genre, and let's start with this one that I have to think inspired a whole lot of people to pick up a harmonica for the first time. Let's listen to Little Walter. Now, Colin, that was, I believe, from 1952, and well, you hear that, and you sort of flash back and say, well, I guess we can see what's coming and where it got its inspiration.
That's some outrageous swing right there. That's Count Basie-type swing, but it's a small band, and it's Walter commandeering the unit that had just been working with Muddy Waters at the end of a session. Now, that's take number one of Juke. So people out there who think juke is just some like sports catchphrase, like he juked him out of his jockstrap. No, this goes way back to the early 1950s, before the 1950s, of course, but that's what Little Walter used for the title. And he is to the harmonica as, how far do we want to extend this? As Paganini was to the violin, as Hendrix was to the guitar, as Charlie Parker was to the alto saxophone. He was a bona fide virtuoso, and the harmonica is one of my favorite instruments. Fascinates me. Someone like Keith Relf and the Yardbirds, I fell in love with his voice and his harmonica playing and then that band. But Little Walter was, think of how early this is too. Elvis hasn't happened yet. Still years off. Bo Diddley hasn't happened yet. You have Chester Burnett, aka Howlin' Wolf, doing some of the things he's going to do, but he's doing them in Memphis. He's not doing them up in Chicago yet. So this is very much in a Chicago vein. And Little Walter was one of those people, too. He doesn't sing on this number. But he's also like Hendrix as a singer. You don't think of him as a great singer, but he was a great singer. And so, yes, it radicalized that instrument because the harmonica was seen as like a novelty instrument almost. It wasn't seen as something that could be, you hear how he's out front with that band and the swagger. And when we talk about the top bands, it's so easy to talk about jazz bands, Miles Davis Quintet, one or two, or a rock band like Cream, that just that sound. But there's some great bands in blues, and this ad hoc unit, for the purpose of Little Walter being the leader, was certainly one of them. And then there's a second take of this song. And did you get a chance to listen to that?
I did.
Now, normally when we have like a second take of a song, and anyone who like collects box sets knows this, there is kind of like an attempt to do what had just been done. So they nail it, this crucial take in take one, then they completely mix it up on take two. And there aren't a lot of instances like that. Walter starts the second take of Juke with a harmonica cadenza, which you wouldn't ever normally have any kind of cadenza to begin a song. Louis Armstrong did this occasionally, but that's the touchstone, and it becomes, it's a little bit wonky, and it doesn't have the same rhythmic heft and swagger, but you just see the modernistic playfulness, the risk-taking that was just so central to all of Walter's music during his glory run of the 50s.
All right, let's go from there down to Texas and check out a little Blind Lemon Jefferson.
Told me late last night, you don't need no mama no how.
One of those many artists who didn't have a long life, but certainly had a whole lot of influence, Colin.
Black Snake Bone is one of your classic double entendres. So if you were going to cut your own version, Kimball, you would necessarily have to call it White Snake Moan. But I think we all know what he's talking about here with said snake of this song, and Blind Lemon Jefferson was someone who was quite no-nonsense when he went to his session. So he wasn't like, ha, 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 I'm being racy. Listen to like this sexy thing I'm singing, and you ladies know what it's about. He was quite professional, and the thing that, at the time, he was seen as this, believe it or not, because to me it sounds so radical. I think anyone listening to that can hear, hopefully they can hear, how radical that music remains. So this is 1926. And the way he plays the guitar is striking. It's such a free-form way of playing guitar. When we think of the blues, we often think of electric blues, and we think of the 12-bar format. This isn't a 12-bar blues. It's much more, it's like freestyle blues, isn't it? You hear like the little embellishments he does on the guitar. And as a singer, again, I hope people can hear this, he was just so technically perfect, skilled. Listen to the size of his voice. Listen to the whole scope and size of the sound. It's just some guy, that's what we're going to get with a bunch of these, alone with his guitar. I remember like when I first heard Dylan on stage, like in 63 and 64, and it was just him whipping up this storm with the mic and the guitar, and that was it. It was so impressive to me. And so Dylan is even pulling from this tradition too. You cover numbers by people like this, but yeah, this was one, like if you were into Robert Johnson, you quickly found yourself being into Blind Lemon Jefferson.
Let's move from there. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Back to Chicago, and a guy who did a little of everything through the years. Great songwriter, singer, musician, arranger, record producer. Here's a classic from Willie Dixon.
Thank you.
for days.
The romantic stories about the guys who died young are great, but I also love the people like Willie Dixon and Muddy Waters who hung around long enough to at least experience some of the appreciation that modern artists had for their work.
Definitely, and one of the earliest versions of this song was in 1961 by Howlin' Wolf, and there was some dissension later about how much of this might have been by Wolf and how much was by Willie Dixon. We get that a lot with the blues. You'll notice that there are phrases that come up all the time. The idea of the rooster that doesn't crow. It's like a bird pun. When it's supposed to, and two trains are running. Like, we see these lyrical fragments run through so many different songs. It's similar to jazz that way. Like, you'll see the same chords of, like, a given I Got Rhythm song that will be extrapolated into Charlie Parker's Cherokee and all that kind of thing. So in jazz, it's normally with the actual chord progression, but in blues, it's with the lyrical progressions we more commonly see this. So this was a song, again, it's another double entendre in the Little Red Rooster and being driven home and all that. I think we all know what that's about, and the Rolling Stones fell in love with the song. And you're right, Willie Dixon was someone who was able to see the people who appreciate his music. So was Howlin' Wolf, because you really just had to last into the mid to late 60s to be able to pick up on how much you meant to people if you were these guys. And what's interesting about a number of them too is that they seem to be these wizened men who've gone so far in the world, and they're ageless. They might as well be 800, but they weren't. And so, yes, with the Delta Blues guys, they can hail from the 19th century, but that's not going to be a case with a number of the Electric Chicago musicians. And I'm working on what hopefully will be a finalized book deal soon on British rhythm and blues. And it starts off, and the excerpt is up in the blog of the Rolling Stones going to Chess in the summer, Chess recording studios in Chicago in the summer of 64. And they see this guy out there, like the custodian in the hallway, and it's their hero. It's Willie Dixon. He's like just sort of like fixing a light bulb. So he was really the jack of all trades at that particular historical label.
All right, up next, well, I think if you want to hear about his tasty a set of the blues, as you'll find, to me it's all embodied in this from Sonny Boy Williams, and this is just great.
It took me a long time to find out my mistake. It took me a long time to find out my mistake. It sure did, man. But I bet you my bottom dollar, I'm not fighting no more frog for snakes.
Oh man, is that's something else. I love that.
This is Sonny Boy Williamson number two.
That is number two, yes.
Yes, this is Rice, a.k.a. Rice Miller. So he called himself Sonny Boy Williamson because there was another guy who would be like, you're Rich Kimball and you're so successful. And I called myself Rich Kimball and they had to call me Rich Kimball too. And you were number one. So there we have it. And there was obviously another Sonny Boy Williamson predating this one who died young. And a lot of these people die like horribly young and tragically and wretched circumstances. We'll really come to about the worst one shortly. But I think this is one of the best titles in the history of just music. The idea of fattening frogs for snakes. And it was a thing. And it wasn't a saying that we recognize now, but when you harvested frogs from the swamp, because you were going to eat them, you fattened them up like you would the animals on the farm. And then some black racer, black snake moan, comes in and plucks your frog. Like, you put all the work into feeding this guy. It's like, have some worms, have some minnows, fella. And this black racer comes in and goes, oh, I will have a frog. Thank you, sir. And departs again. So it's really a song about wasted energy, pouring forth all of this effort, not getting anything coming back. And we have, again, another amazing harmonica player, not at the level of a Little Walter. I don't really think we can get to Little Walter's level, but he's going to be hugely influential. Sonny Boy Williamson II, he goes to England, and he plays, or rather they play with him. The Animals and the Yardbirds, and there are all these like early recordings from 63 of those bands trying to deal with this guy on the stage, because he wasn't like, okay, we're going to play it this way. You never knew what he was going to do, because he was often drunk. He was kind of crazy. So you had to just try and get this sort of like lesson in being in a band by hanging on and not being left behind with what this guy was doing.
All right. Up next, man, you talk about your painful stories. We'll talk about the demise of Bessie Smith, but first, an absolutely haunting recording from
1927.
We had a little John Hurt leaking in there at the beginning, but man, yeah. Bessie Smith.
I heard that.
You can't bear both of them at the same time. It's just too much.
Yeah, it sure is. And we can really hear with that Bessie Smith number from 1927, the melding, how closely related they are, jazz and the blues. Because what do you even want to call her? Like, I pitched something on her on the song recently to Jazz Times. Because I would suppose I look at her first as a jazz singer, and you can also hear the horn-like quality of her voice. And that's something that Billie Holiday was going to pick up on. So I think Billie Holiday got a lot from Bessie Smith. What this song is about, Send Me to the Electric Chair, which is a request. It's like a request to the judge. It's a song of female empowerment, I would say, in some ways. Decades before you'd expect that kind of thing, where the singer is essentially saying, I killed my husband. He sucked ass. I got my money's worth. It was worth it. I'd do it again. Send me to hell. Shades of the Christmas play we were talking about a few weeks ago. I don't mind. That's cool. And she pleads, the singer does, with the judge to locate her next to Satan. And I just love that idea of it was worth it. It's like, what's that song, Porter Wagoner, where he comes home and the cold hard facts of life, right? Where he's like, now he catches his wife in bed with another guy,
right?
Like, knifes the guy. And then he just thinks, he's so happy. He's like, now who taught who the cold hard facts of life? That's the country version of this song. And she has that voice. Imagine the challenges to recording that voice at the time, because the voice is huge. There's so much volume in the voice. The voice is orchestral, and it's just this one person. In terms of pipe power, I don't see how anyone in the early days of recorded sound in this country had, that's like Caruso type of like pipes power. And that was Bessie Smith. Good one.
Because in those days, back in the late 20s, those weren't electronic recordings yet, right?
No, this is all rather primitive, and we talked about that ghost story recording from 1905, so things have progressed, but when you listen to, and I mentioned Robert Johnson, and Robert Johnson is around the same, he's after this time period, so he's like in the late 30s, and here we are, like I said, so he's 10 years after this, and when you even hear Robert Johnson, because it's somebody like in a hotel room, and they're just set up that way, And it sounds like you're listening not to a studio recording, but an audience recording of a live gig or a field recording. And really, they were field recordings that just happened to be made indoors. And so, yeah, they can sound rough-hewn at first, but then I think you want them that way. They work best that way because they have this primal power to them, this primal sort of protean power to her voice that I don't think would work as well or translate so readily if it was all just sort of like pristine, click track, all that kind of stuff.
Now, I knew Bessie Smith had been killed in a car accident. I didn't know the awful details until I was researching for our conversation. Oh, my God, what a way to go.
Right, and it sort of like fed into the American theater later and became like this Arthur Miller thing, and that she was, so she's in the horrible car accident. She could be saved. And some of this is stuff that we don't really know, because it wasn't like everyone whipped out a cell phone and put it up on Twitter. And so sometimes it's a matter of parsing between like what was the reality and what was apocryphal. But the gist of the death story is that she would have been able to be saved if her skin color hadn't precluded her from prompt treatment. So that's why Bessie Smith. There's so many, it's funny, it's not funny, it's like horrible funny, but in the blues and in jazz, and also in Soviet hockey, there are so many deaths by auto accident. Chu Berry, not Chuck Berry, Chu Berry, the great tenor saxophone player, is another like succumbed that way. And Charlie Parker he didn't die from it, but he had a horrible like car crash. There was just an awful lot of it. And you see so many stories like this. And like I said, a lot of the Soviet players were like drinking because they could finally cut loose or whatever, and their lives were so miserable, so worthy of singing the blues, really, in that communist regime. So it's like hockey blues and death on roads.
All right, let's stick right about the same time period, I think a year later, than that Bessie Smith recording. Here's Mississippi John Hurt.
Ain't nobody's dirty business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but mine. Ain't nobody's doggone business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but my own. These mornings gonna wake up crazy, gonna grab my gun, kill my baby. Nobody's business but mine. Ain't nobody's doggone business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but my own.
So many modern singers, folk singers, rock singers, blues singers, influenced by Mississippi John Hurt. You can hear elements of Dylan in there and so much more.
I would say that Mississippi John Hurt was the first blues artist I listened to like every day on a loop. So if you walked into my college dorm room when I was like 19 years old, there's a good chance you would have heard these recordings from 1928 that he made for the OK label. And he was going to be rediscovered later, so we get these recordings on like the coffee house circuit. You get some of those, too, with, like, Sun House. Like, a lot of these guys kind of came back, and they play at college in the Midwest, and there are a lot of recordings like that. But this is, like, the real deep vein stuff of Mississippi John Hurt. It's a fascinating song. It's a highly melodic song. He's not the rhythmic player that these other people are. He was someone who was more McCartney. He was more melody. And the song, which he delivers straight-faced vocally, I always found it like hilarious in some ways, chilling in others, because the singer is saying, hey, it's not your business, like how things go down with me and my girl and the way she treats me. So it's almost like he's henpecked and he's saying, don't say that I don't stand up for myself. Then he transitions a couple times And we have lyrics like, one of these days I'm going to wake up boozy. You know how that is, Kimball. That's never good. I'm going to grab my gun and kill old Susie. Makes it sound like a sick mule out in the backyard, but it's probably his wife.
Yeah.
And so then he wraps it up at the end. He changes again. He's like, all right, you let her, baby. It'll be cool. I've worked out my issues. Come back. And if I was the woman, I'd be like, you might wake up bruising. I wouldn't want anything to do with that guy.
Finally, in our little tour of the blues this afternoon, a guy who did a little of everything. He was a singer, guitarist, an evangelist as well, and a little touch of gospel here from Blind Willie Johnson.
On me, let it shine on me, let your light from the light out shine on me, let it shine on me. Let it shine on me. Let your light from the light out shine on. My Lord, he done just what he said. Let your light from the light out shine on me. And raise the dead. Let your light from the light out shine on.
Been a lot of different versions of that through the years, but boy, Blind Willie Johnson, you hear that version, he makes it his own.
And we didn't even quite get to the part where it's going to transition to him. You can't see it coming. No one would expect it to come. It's one of the great shocking moments in all of American art, where he transitions to chest singing. And what he does the first time he does that is he starts with his boot, like pounding out a rhythm on the floor. And the second time, when you think he might do that, he leaves the boot out of it, which is, again, highly unpredictable. But what I would say is Blind Willie Johnson made the most powerful musical art, or certainly there isn't, just for sheer power, there isn't musical art more powerful than this in the history of American music. I don't think, if you could transpose Moby Dick to the blues, you'd have Blind Willie Johnson. And we're, again, riffing on that idea. He's singing about a lighthouse here. And we've talked in the past, a couple of years ago, about the Christmas Carol, I Saw Three Ships. And there's that double entendre with that, because the three ships also refers to not just like there's the harbor and there are the three ships, but three camels, like desert ships and wise men traveling and all this kind of stuff. So Blind Willie Johnson is riffing off all of that kind of biblical imagery by way of the seashore. And his Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground. Like, if you had to pick one blues song, like, what's it all about? It's going to be that. This song to me has a note of hope in it that I like a lot. And you hear the little guitar fill he does before he inches closer to the chorus. And this guy, talk about like difficult life. He only cuts a handful of songs, the tracks. Like he lives a bunch of years after that, but he eventually dies. His house catches fire and he was too poor to move anywhere. So think about this, Kimball. He lives in the charred ruins of his house. I mean, yeah, it makes me feel a little bit better about the hovel I live in, but at least he had a house. And then he contracts like malarial fever and dies. But this man is his real Keith Melville, Blind Willie Johnson. He's at their level. There is just, you need to get this suffused into your soul. You need to hear this before you yourself leave.
And we've talked about this many times before with other types of art. Thank you, Internet. It's all available out there. So no reason not to dig deeper. You got some introductions today, but explore more and learn about these and so many other great artists that really are the essential, I think, American music form.
Yeah, I can't overstate the... we've talked about energy. And there is no great work of art that does not have a huge component of energy. That doesn't mean rah-rah. I was thinking about you the other day. You asked me sometime, it's like, how do you make those stories so alive, those characters so alive, like right away? He's actually in bed thinking about this. And a large part of it is energy. They're just the force of life. What Mary Shelley is trying to have, like, Frankenstein put into that cadaver, the life force. It's the same with art. And you get the life force with all of these musicians, but especially the sides of our last friend there. So, yeah, I would check out all of that. Don't be a lazy plonker.
Exactly. Good advice as always from Colin Fleming. Thank you, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Let's listen to a little bit more of Blind Willie Johnson as we head into the break.
Shine on me, shine on, and let it shine on. Let your light, Father, light out. Shine on me, shine on, let it shine on. Let your light from the lighthouse shine on me.